Great to have you with us on WPR News. Larry Mueller here, turning our attention to your pet's health today and zeroing in a bit on cancer and your dog or your cat. The American Veterinary Medical Association, I think, notes that about one in four dogs get cancer at some point in their life, and that cancer risk increases to about half or one in two when they're over 10 years of age. So we'll talk about that, and we'll talk about possible treatments with our guest today, Dr. Ruth Ann Chun. She is a veterinary oncologist, a clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine, and it's great to have her with us. And as we talk with her, we'll be taking your pet health questions as we move along, but let's focus a bit on cancer to begin the show. Have you had a cancer-stricken pet? Questions about it. Maybe what do you do to try and help avoid it? Give us a call. The number's 800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or shoot us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, welcome. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thanks for having me, Larry. It's really great to be here.
You're, of course, a veterinary oncologist. You're a clinical professor at UW. How does the school prepare veterinary students to treat pets for cancer?
Oh, boy. I think one of the first things that we do and that we try to emphasize over all 4 years of the curriculum is a good physical examination, how to identify what's normal and recognize what's not normal, and then also working with the client and how do you communicate effectively with them to help help understand what their concerns are, help you explain to them what you might be worried about as well. So really identifying, you know, what's wrong on your physical examination, and then if there is an abnormal mass or lump that you find on a pet, what are the basic steps to approach, you know, figuring out what it is, and then if it is a malignant cancer, what are the tests that you would do to figure out if it's spread elsewhere in the body?
Yeah. So the UW veterinary care, I like the fact that comprehensive is part of the whole of your whole way of doing things. When we talk about comprehensive, what does it mean in terms of this kind of work?
Yeah, so we're very excited now at UW Veterinary Care that we have truly what we call a comprehensive veterinary cancer center. So we provide multiple treatment options: surgery, radiation therapy, medical treatments. We're very proud of the fact that we now have actually a surgical oncologist. So this is a veterinarian who is gone on and done training in surgery and then actually done additional training in how to specifically approach, surgically remove cancers in dogs and cats. So all of our oncologists are trained either in surgical oncology, medical oncology, or radiation oncology. And that kind of treatment combination, along with having a very in-depth research program, is what makes us a comprehensive cancer center.
Yeah, and a good place to go if you have a pet. Are there many others in the state, do you know?
Not comprehensive cancer centers like that. There absolutely are other practices that have really great medical oncologists, for sure.
Yeah. What are the most common types of cancer, let's say, afflicting cats and dogs? I imagine it could be different depending.
It's definitely different. In dogs, probably one of the most common cancers that we see is one called lymphosarcoma or lymphoma. And that is a cancer that affects the lymph nodes, which are structures all throughout the body. And most often, people will recognize that their dog's starting to develop lumps. Typically by their jaw or in front of their shoulders or behind their knees, which is where the lymph nodes are. And the dog might be feeling totally fine, but these lumps are developing. So that's a sign that maybe we should take our dog in and have them looked at. So lymphoma is very common in dogs. Another common skin tumor in dogs is something called mast cell tumors. And those are, of course, lumps in the skin. They can mimic even a fatty tumor or a lipoma. So when we have patients that have lumps that are developing, we do a very basic test called a needle aspirate to just sample some of the cells in that lump, see what they are, looking at them under the microscope. I would say a third relatively common cancer in dogs is hemangiosarcoma, and that's a tumor of the blood vessels. So heme, angio, blood vessel, sarcoma, meaning malignant cancer.
Yeah.
And that is a little bit more of an insidious cancer because it grows inside the belly, inside the body where we can't really see it. And then because the tumor is made up of abnormal blood vessels, what happens is it ruptures, the tumor bleeds, and then we see kind of collapsing episodes in our pets, primarily dogs. So those are some common ones in dogs. Cats, it is different. Cats, we tend to see intestinal tumors, and the cat might have vomiting or diarrhea. And realistically, there are at least 379,000 things that make cats have vomiting and diarrhea.
Yes, that's what I have two cats. Believe me.
Yeah, so it's not a very specific finding, but cats can have intestinal tumors, most commonly lymphoma, again, a small cell form of lymphoma that is very responsive to treatment, and cats can actually live years with that particular disease when being treated. Other tumors that we see in cats, unfortunately, are around the mouth or the nasal cavity. And in small animals, like cats have such small faces, small noses, small mouths, once we find those, it's difficult to remove them surgically. And so the treatment options for those more often are radiation therapy or trying medical therapy.
So lots going on there. Kathleen in La Crosse sent us an email. Actually, she called but couldn't stay with us. She's curious about whether feeding cabbage to a dog can prevent them from getting cancer. Also, Kathleen had a Rottweiler that got sarcoma, and she's wondering if that's common with the breed.
Cabbage first. You know, in humans, of course, those cruciferous vegetables, cabbage, cauliflower, broccoli, are all known to be really helpful in humans in preventing certain types of cancers. There are not studies like that in dogs. There's the one study that I'm aware of actually looked at Scottish terriers and whether or not they got vegetables, and I believe the vegetables were carrots and maybe broccoli. And they did see that in Scottish terriers that got fed some form of vegetables once or twice a week, they were less likely to get bladder cancer, which is a very, very common cancer in Scottish terriers. Cabbage certainly doesn't hurt to give the dog. And I know my dogs love cabbage. So whenever I'm making something, I give them some cabbage. So I don't think it hurts. We're not sure how much it would actually help prevent cancer. The other part of our Rottweilers and sarcomas. Sadly, yes, we do see Rottweilers getting certain types of tumors. One, a bone tumor called osteosarcoma is not uncommon in Rottweilers. We also see lymphoma in Rottweilers or lymphosarcoma, that first tumor type that I talked about. So we do see Rottweilers not uncommonly getting that cancer.
Well, here's another email. Michael emailed to ask, how frequently is cancer in wild canids and felids? How do those frequency compare to domestic dogs and cats? And what are the, I'm wondering about the causes of cancer in domestic cats and dogs.
Such a great question. And I don't know the answer, but I can say that there is a paradox that we see in very, very large animals like whales and elephants, where despite the fact that they have so much more body tissue and more cells in their body, they get cancer actually at a lower rate than one would expect for the size of that animal. So those are studies done on wild animals. In canids and wild canids and felids, what I am aware of are studies on zoo animals or reports on zoo animals that come up. But I don't know what the percentage of, in a wild dog population, wolves, dingoes, you know, what that would be. So it's a great question.
And the terms, and in terms of domestic dogs and cats, causes, I mean, is there something we're doing in terms of feeding, or is it just luck of the genes?
There's definitely a genetic component, just as there is with people. But as you stated earlier, it's such a common disease in dogs and cats, just like it is in people. We have not identified a specific cause for specific types of tumors. You know, unlike the link with certain chemicals in people, or smoking obviously is associated with cancer in people, investigators have looked into, does secondhand smoke cause cancer? Do we see that more commonly in dogs or cats that live in a house with a smoker? The answer so far has been no. It's really difficult to identify in the diet because dogs are fed such a wide range of diets, and the same with cats. Is there a specific thing that they're getting? So undoubtedly, if they're exposed to toxic chemicals at a high rate, that's probably going to put them at increased risk. But the average dog and cat, we don't really know why they would develop cancer.
I think I should talk a little bit more about treatments for cancer in dogs and cats. I assume it's a little, I'm probably pretty sure it's different between dogs and cats.
It is different, and it depends a lot on the tumor type, actually. And so the tumor type and whether it's spread systemically throughout the body dictates how we treat. So as a medical oncologist, I treat animals that have cancers that are spread or are likely to spread to other sites in the body. And so things like lymphoma, some aggressive mast cell tumors, hemangiosarcoma or osteosarcoma, all pretty common tumors that have aggressive biologic behavior, where you might see a spot on a limb or in their spleen, and based on the cancer type, we know it's going to be aggressive. It's going to go to other places. We will treat both dogs and cats with chemotherapy. So we do use the same drugs that are used in humans. Lymphoma is a pretty common disease in people as well. And we use actually a very similar chemotherapy protocol in dogs and cats with lymphoma as we do in people. Of course, the big difference is one, it's incredibly expensive if we were to treat a dog or a cat with a bone marrow transplant like they do for some humans with lymphoma.
Oh, my goodness. I'd hate to pay that one.
Right. And it doesn't necessarily prolong their survival.
Mm.
So we are much less aggressive with the dose of the drug that animal gets based on its body weight compared to a human. The dog would get a much smaller dose than what the human would get. We don't combine drugs as aggressively. We want our patients home with their people, feeling as good as possible so that they can have good quality time with their people. So medical oncology is, is a lot of people have experience with chemotherapy and they're worried about it. And our goal as medical oncologists for dogs and cats is to control the tumor, improve the quality of life, and keep that animal with its person for longer.
Makes good sense. Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, our guest today, veterinary oncologist and clinical professor in the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. It's great to have her with us. Questions for her? I hope you'll join in. We've zeroed in on cancer for the moment. I want to talk about some other aspects of her life and role. She started something called WhiskCares. And I really would like to talk about that as well with her. You can join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email us to talk@wpr.org. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, our guest today, veterinary oncologist with the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her with us. And if you have a question or comment, I hope you'll join in. The number's 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. You mentioned in passing that this can be an expensive proposition. I thought about pet insurance. Is pet insurance typically ever cover anything like some of the high-end cancer treatments that are available?
Absolutely. I'm so glad you asked that question because we do have a relatively small percentage of our clients still that have pet insurance. And when they do, it's not, price is not an issue for them because insurance, pet insurance typically covers around 80%. Excuse me, of the fees. And so it makes a huge difference in their ability to pursue additional treatments.
So, and the right kind of pet insurance.
Yes, and that's, I think that there are many good options for pet insurance. If you go to the American Veterinary Medical Association website, they have a list of a variety of different options for pet insurance.
Which is, I would be tempted to go there to get non-biased, I guess, information.
Yes, that's exactly right, yeah.
I mentioned WISCARES just before our little break. In 2014, you started WISCARES. What does that stand for and what does it do?
That's
great.
Yes, so WISCARES is the Wisconsin Companion Animal Resources, Education, and Social Services. So we started this program because we recognized that there's a lot, well, and originally there was a gentleman who was experiencing homelessness, and he had a dog, and he came to the vet school, and his dog had an ear infection. He wanted help to take care of his dog. He did not have any money to do anything, and despite the fact that the hospital has a fund to help folks like him in that situation, he fell through the cracks. And he did not receive assistance. He went down the street to a different building on campus that had the sign Veterinary Science. So it was quite a while ago. It's a few years ago. And said, gosh, my dog's got an ear infection. They can't help me at the vet school. Will you help me here? Of course they helped him. And the administrator at that veterinary science building turned around and sent an email to the dean, who was at that time Mark Markell, and said, what are you guys doing at the vet school? This poor guy fell through the cracks. And Dean Markell turned to me as I was the hospital director at that time and said, hey, this is, you're running the hospital. What do you want to do? And so he supported me in developing a program where we were initially providing care to animals owned by folks that are experiencing homelessness. And so we started out just doing street outreach, providing, basic vaccinations, antibiotics, a little bit of wellness care. And within a couple of years, recognized that it's just a gigantic need. Veterinary care is expensive. The medications go through the same types of approvals and have the same expense as they do on the human side. Medical equipment is expensive. Our training is expensive. So it's expensive to provide veterinary care. And yet there are so many people that have pets that love them and that find this difficult to afford. So there is a concept now in veterinary medicine called access to veterinary medical care or access to care and spectrum of care where we try to very intentionally stop using the term, well, the best way to treat this particular thing is this, or the gold standard of treatment is this. Because when you say gold standard or best, and then say, but if that's too expensive, here's some other options. It's like, well, that sounds terrible. What do you mean? So we try and say, the medical option that is going to probably provide the longest amount of, or the most effective cure is this one. here's the, you know, that's the positive about it. Here's the downsides about it. It's expensive. It takes a long time. You might have a lot of trips back and forth. Here are some other options. So you're providing people with a spectrum of options. And that is what we do now intentionally at WiskCares. I will say to all the veterinarians listening out there, that's what veterinarians do every day. They have to be able to provide that. And it's become a much more intentional, how do we teach that? How do we teach that to our students so that when they go out into practice, they don't feel like they're offering not good enough medicine? So it's a mindset that we want them to understand. So now WiskCares actually has a full-service veterinary clinic. It's located on the east side of town, south side of town. It's away from the vet school. We have three veterinarians, two veterinary technicians that work there. We are able to offer surgeries, x-rays, ultrasound, lab work. We have fantastic receptionists. And we also have two social workers that work there. So we provide care at kind of different tiers based on people's housing status and based on people's income as well.
So there is, it's not just homeless, it's lower income.
Lower income, yes. So we, so people will have to be, have to apply to become a WiskCares client. They are renewed annually so that hopefully their situation gets better and they don't need to use us. Veterinary students are there learning and seeing the clients, working with the patients and the clients. And then our three veterinarians are also there supervising those students. And so we try to provide really good spectrum of care to our clients and their animals while also helping our veterinary students learn. The social services part of WiskCares is with our two social workers, fantastic people. And we know that there are services that are in Madison that can help people and families that they're not always connected with. So our social workers can help connect people with some of those services. They can sit down and talk to folks that are struggling and offer kind of ideas and brainstorming on ways to help. And then they also run a program that will foster an animal for up to 90 days. And we have come across a situation multiple times where somebody needs their own inpatient medical care, surgery, you know, heart work. Sometimes it's inpatient mental health care. Sometimes it's temporary incarceration, and they need somewhere for their pet to be. And so we will, we have foster families, incredible dedicated foster families that will take pets for up to 90 days while their person is can't be with them.
Yeah.
And then we'll end up reuniting them so that that is not part of the worry or part of the refusal for somebody to go and get their own medical care.
That's a fantastic service. One of the things that when we have veterinarians on, a lot of times somebody will call and say, I can't afford. And
yes.
Under a lot, it seems like under a pretty good set of circumstances, somebody, at least in this area of the state, would be able to get that.
So
qualify for the help.
So yes, they have to qualify for the help, and certainly we try to serve primarily folks in Dane County, but we know we have folks from all over that come to us. And I will also say that there are a number of other veterinary clinics in the Madison area that try and offer, you know, really intentional spectrum of care. I don't want to say discounted or it's not even subsidized, but try to be affordable. They try and give folks options that are affordable to them.
Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, our guest today, veterinary oncologist and clinical professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll talk some more, I think, about WiskCares, but we have Tyler in Kokana with a question about Tyler's dog. Let's go there.
Yeah, hello. So I have a six-year-old English chocolate lab, and a few months ago we noticed that she had a small bump or lump on her right upper leg, kind of shoulder area. And at first we decided just to kind of monitor it and see if it got any bigger. And it did get a little bit bigger. So we decided to take her into the vet. And the vet recommended to just have it removed right away. But the downfall of having it removed right away is this doctor didn't feel comfortable doing surgery because she is 90 pounds, which is a little overweight for her. So she didn't want us to do the surgery right away. Instead, she wanted us to try to get the dog to lose some weight. But the recommended weight loss was, you know, extending us out, you know, 2 years to get her to the ideal weight. So I guess just my question is, what are your thoughts on that? She didn't recommend doing a needle biopsy or anything like that. In 2 years seems like a long time to wait if it is cancer. Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's it's hard. From what you're describing, I'm wondering if the tumor is on the skin or under the skin or attached to the bone. Can you tell?
Yeah, it's just under the skin, just but it's skin. Not attached to the bone.
Okay. So I guess from what you're telling me, yes, 2 years does seem like it's a long time to wait to try and get a sample of that. And I will also add that different just like different doctors have different areas that they're more comfortable or stronger in, if your veterinarian hasn't done a lot of needle aspirates, that might be something that is keeping her from being comfortable offering that as an option. I don't know if you asked her about whether or not she could do that.
Yeah, I did. She said that she recommends just doing the surgery to have it removed because you could not get results and you might not know from the needle aspiration if it is cancer or not. But then if it is cancer, it's going to require surgery to remove it anyway.
Mm-hmm. So she's trying to help you just kind of jump right to the chase there. And she's completely unwilling to do the surgery sooner?
Yeah, she said that she would like the dog to be somewhere around 50 to 55 pounds. And it's kind of difficult for me to see her at that weight because she's an English lab, so she's short and stocky, and her mom was very big, and her dad is very big.
Yeah. So we got a big dog anyway, so it's hard to, I mean, you're not in a position without seeing the dog to be able to tell exactly, but what would you, if it was your dog, what would you do?
So if it was my dog, I probably would try the needle aspirate. Just to have a little peace of mind first. And, you know, the other option with 100% due respect to your current veterinarian is maybe look for a second opinion, possibly.
Yeah, yeah. Might want to do that as well, Tyler. And thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too. Number to call 800-642-1234. Email to talk@wpr.org. Susan emailed to ask if human papillomavirus can be transferred from touching one dog and then touching another dog.
Boy, that's a great question. Dogs definitely are impacted by their own papillomavirus. I'm going to invoke a name that we talked about a little bit earlier today before we were on the air here is with Sandy Sawchuk, who is taught me when I was in vet school, and I greatly admired her. And I'm thinking to myself, what would Sandy Sawchuk say right now? Because I don't have a good answer for you. I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. That's a great question.
Sean emailed to say they had two lab retrievers that passed away due to cancer 8 or 9 years ago. Now has a wonderful miniature schnauzer who they want to ensure life as long as possible. Are there specific cancers common to the miniature schnauzer? And if so, what should they be looking for?
Oh, boy, that's a great question. I will say we don't see that many miniature schnauzers in our oncology practice, so that's one thing that's probably a good thing to be happy about. What I would watch for with the schnauzer would be enlargement of the lymph nodes that I talked about earlier, potentially for looking for lymphoma, looking more for skin masses. Schnauzers are not a breed that we would tend to be worried about with bone cancers or with cancers of the spleen. as we see those more often in larger breed dogs. So that's positive news for you and your schnauzer as well.
John wonders, has a cat that in its stool saw some dark red blood in a small amount. Wondering, is that a concern?
So there's, just like with vomiting and diarrhea, there's a lot of different reasons why cats might have some blood in their stool. It could be just because of constipation. It could potentially be because of parasites. It would be one that I would think would be worth bringing a sample to your veterinarian so they could analyze it, make sure there's no intestinal parasites. And maybe also they could do a physical exam on your cat and see if they can identify, is there an obvious mass or other concerns associated with the intestinal tract.
Okay. Karen in Rhinelander, it's your turn. Hi, Karen. Thank you for calling.
Hi. This is not an animal question per se, but I live in the northern counties of Wisconsin, and while we have many vets here, none of them offer after-hour services anymore. And is there a way to, I don't know, petition or advertise or something to try and get after-hour veterinary service here, the closest one being in Marathon County, but I have not needed to use it, but several of my friends have said, you know, calling there, they are usually told right away that they are booked and they are turfed down to Madison, Eau Claire, Appleton, and that's a 3.5 or better hour drive. You know, I mean, there's no one here for, you know, Oneida, Vilas, Florence, Forest, Ironwood. You know, I mean, nothing is here after hours or after like 12 o'clock on a Saturday.
Wow. Oh, I feel for you. That's got to be scary to be in that position. I guess the first thing that have you talked to your veterinarians and asked why they've done away with having those after-hour services? That's kind of the first place that I would start. There is no effective arm. There's no one that will say you have to have an after-hour service here. There's no kind of governing body that would do that. The Wisconsin Veterinary Medical Association. Every state has their own veterinary medical association, so you could certainly contact the WVMA and ask for assistance. It would all boil back down to the veterinarians in your area, whether or not they're willing and able to open that back up again. It's a lot of work, especially with a shortage of veterinarians that go out into some of the more rural areas or smaller areas. And there are also corporate veterinary emergency practices. The one that comes to mind right immediately is the Veterinary Emergency Group, or VEG, that sets up practices in areas specifically to help with emergencies. But it would depend on probably their ability to make it financially.
Make it financially worthwhile, I guess you might as well say. I'm thinking back and I'm remembering a talk somewhere, and I can't even remember the name, but it was an area kind of like that, but there were some different practices that kind of got together and sort of rotated.
Yep. They would who takes call on various days or nights.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I know that was working reasonably well, and I can't remember the area, but that might be something else Karen could bring up with the local vet practices.
Sometimes it comes down to they're just spread too thin, and they can't, you know, work 80-hour weeks all the time, and that it's just not possible, and it's a tough situation.
Yeah, a very tough. But, again, going back, so VEG was?
Veterinary Emergency Group, VEG,
would be one place for Karen to go.
It's a corporate veterinary practice that is across the United States, and that might be something that she could get them to set up a clinic there. There's no guarantees, but that's just an example.
Karen, I'm Sorry for your situation there. I appreciate it very much, but I hope you'll look into some of the options we were just talking about. Shirley and Merrill has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Shirley.
Hi. I have a little Cavalier, and don't know exactly how old she is. I got her from the shelter, but she's somewhere around between 10 and 12. And I noticed, and I have not talked to my vet yet, that she has a little tag right on her left eyelid. Mm-hmm. It does not seem to bother her. It bothers me. Mm-hmm. Do we just ignore it?
So eyelid tumors are, the most common eyelid tumors are benign. So I'm going to say that that is good, that it's not like something that's likely to cause her problems. If it bothers you, it's not necessarily something that I would hurry to take off, but if she is being anesthetized for, say, a dental procedure or has another mass that's being removed, that would be a relatively straightforward. Again, I'm not seeing it, but usually eyelid masses, kind of the tags like you're describing, are relatively easy to remove, so that would be something you could consider. I'm not sure that I would encourage you to do that just to remove the eyelid mass, but yeah, if there's something else going on.
Where the cat has to be anesthetized.
Did you say a Cavalier?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry, the dog.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Cavalier dog. Shirley, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. And Vivian in Green Bay, we'll go to you. Hi, Vivian.
Hi. I have a comment regarding veterinarian ability. For more than 60 years, I've had multiple pets, up to six. Currently, I have five. And when the emergency services left Green Bay, I developed two different vet clinic relationships. Essentially, I spread my dogs and cats out. So if I have an emergency, I can beg because I have two relationships. I can always hope that one of them will squeeze my pet in.
That's another interesting, great tip and technique that you might try in an area where you don't have an emergency practice. So thanks for sharing that.
Yeah, thank you, Vivian. Appreciate it very much. Dr. Ruth Ann Chine, our guest today, veterinary oncologist and clinical professor at UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you with us here on WPR News, taking a look at your pet's health today, talking with Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, veterinary oncologist at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. And questions for her? I hope you'll join in. The number to call, 800-642-1234. You could email to talk at WPR.org. We've talked about a bit about WISCares, and we've talked, obviously, zeroed in on cancer in your pet with Dr. Chun, but we may be able to answer some other questions as well as we move along. Here's one from Mike in Partyville. His cat is 18 and blind, caused by high blood pressure. The cat's on a daily med to control hypertension. In addition, Mike's cat seems to have dementia, evidenced by walking in circles and staring at the wall. The cat doesn't always tell which direction sounds are coming from. Ike says his cat seems content, purrs, and very affectionate, eats well, uses the litter box. How can Mike tell if the cat has got dementia and if it's causing him discomfort? I think is a major.
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think for so many of our pets, how are they happy or not? Are they comfortable or not? The basic answer is if he's eating and drinking and you know, interacting with you, those are all great signs that quality of life is good. With the hypertension and the blindness and the occasionally maybe walking into walls or not being able to localize sound, I always wonder, well, why are they hypertensive? Just like in humans, you can have primary hypertension or you can have hypertension secondary to other problems, other underlying diseases. So that's certainly something that I would want to know more about or get checked out with my veterinarian. Even in older animals, sometimes we'll see changes inside the brain not necessarily dementia-related, but with similar signs where they're starting to not behave normally, and doing something like an MRI, magnetic resonance imaging, just like we do in people. We have the ability to do that in dogs and cats. That might be another test that you could consider coming for, working with a neurologist, either at UW Veterinary Care or at other areas and specialty clinics, just to see is there something more going on that we could potentially address.
Liz in Eagle, Wisconsin. We'll go to you now. Hi, Liz.
Hi there. I have a Sheltie who has, I don't know if it's a papilloma or a sebaceous cyst. I don't know the difference. It's on her off shoulder. She's had it for several years, I would say 3, maybe 4 years. It doesn't grow very fast, but it's bigger now than when I first noticed it. It's probably, almost like an eighth of an inch sticks above the skin right now. I wonder if that's something I should have a needle aspiration done on or something I should be concerned about.
So it sounds like it's been there for quite a long time and slowly growing. And if you were to come to see me, I would do a needle aspirate of it to say, yes, this is what it is. It sounds like from what you're describing that it looks like a almost like a little warty, kind of a soft, hairless, raised lesion. Is that right? I'm just wondering if the... from what you're describing, it sounds like it is a benign growth.
Okay.
And one reason why sometimes people end up taking those off is if it gets in the animal's way and they keep on abrading it and it bleeds or, you know, opens up. But otherwise, if it's just continuing to be very small and not bothering the dog, then I think it's reasonable to leave it.
Yeah. Is it? But maybe a needle aspiration since it's been...
Those are usually relatively easy to sample, yes, just to see what it is.
Just to see what it is. So, Liz, there you go, and good luck. Appreciate your call. Pat in Chippewa Falls, your turn. Hi, Pat.
Hi. I'm not sure if the doctor knows much about or even believes in it because I found doctors that don't, about littermate syndrome.
How do you describe that, Pat?
You know, when you purchase two puppies, you know, that are brother and sister or sisters or from the same litter.
Yeah. And what is the syndrome that's connected with that you're thinking about?
The syndrome is that they bond so closely together that they don't appear to need their people,
and thus
they don't listen.
Mm. So
that's a behavior question.
That's a great behavior question. I would wonder how much time you have them separated where you're working with them as individuals, and then making sure that even once you have kind of the basics with each dog as an individual, then being able to work with them as a pair on basic commands. But that's a great question, and that is out beyond my ability to answer beyond what I just said.
Yeah. Well, but I think you're on the right track. I remember all my times with Dr. Patricia McConnell, as we had calling all pets, and she would always recommend, hey, don't take them both out at the same time for walks. Take one out and then take the other one out and try to do things separately.
Yes. Yep. To establish that connection and relationship between you and the dog.
Yeah. That's something for you to kind of work on and think about, Pat. Appreciate your call very much. Back to WhiskCares for just a minute. And this is, to me, it sounds like a win-win because people that are low income or have no home have an opportunity to qualify for this and get very good care in Madison, maybe their pets, get very good care across a broad range of services. How successful has it been? I mean, it's been going since 2014, I think it started.
Yep, it's been going since 2014. In 2018, because of the need in the community, we actually, that's when we moved into the rental property that we're currently in. And the need is constant. And we recognize that not only in Dane County in Wisconsin, but nationally across the country. There are other groups that are trying to, that have access to care clinics, that are trying to meet people where they are financially and logistically to be able to help them and their animal. So it is, I feel that our program, the WisCares program, has been very successful both in helping people, helping their animals, and teaching veterinary students how to work with a wide range of clients, how to recognize that good medicine can be helping the person and animal in the way that works for them.
Marcy in Antigo emailed to ask, well, she has a 12-year-old domestic short hair cat and recently stopped jumping up onto anything. Or Macy. Macy took her to the vet and was told perhaps she had hurt her back because she walks a little bit hunched. Macy's vet gave gabapentin for the cat. Macy was hoping that this would provide pain relief, but has yet to see improvement. Is there anything you can do to help your cat's back heal so that she can enjoy a normal life again?
That's a great question. So without maybe doing some x-rays and looking to see is there evidence of arthritis that sometimes we see in cats, just like in dogs and people, as they get older, that might be something where she might need periodically, if the gabapentin's not helping, other medications to just help her feel a little bit more comfortable, less achy. So I would work with your veterinarian, let them know the gabapentin's not helping. See what they think, if it's worth doing some x-rays or other tests to try and maybe nail down the problem a little bit more specifically so then you can identify how can I help my cat.
Yeah. And Deb in La Crosse emailed to ask, how to handle bloat in dogs? Can it be prevented or dealt with in transit to an emergency vet, which is 2 hours away?
Oh, gosh. Bloat is a difficult thing. Once it's happened, once it's started, it can be very difficult to decompress their stomach. So bloat is where the stomach swells up with air. So animals might be swallowing air. Sometimes the stomach itself gets so full that it actually even twists, and then the air is stuck in there. So it's a gastric dilatation and volvulus, and that is a real medical emergency. The short answer is that there's preventive-wise, there are some clinics that when they do a spay or neuter on a very deep-chested dog breed, they will preventively tack the stomach to the body wall so that it can't twist, which is really the life-threatening part of that gastric dilatation. It's the volvulus or the twist. But beyond that, I don't know of an effective way to prevent bloat.
Yeah, and so you need to get to the vet as soon as you can.
Yep.
Even if it's 2 hours away.
Mm-hmm.
Wow, we've gotten a range of questions here with our guest, Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, and she will be with us, staying with us right to the bottom of the hour. So it's great to have her continue on. And of course, you can join in with your questions, and I hope you do. The number to call, 800-642-1234, email to talk at WPR.org. At the bottom of the hour, we're going to be talking about a new law that is in effect prohibiting the collection and keeping as pets, wild reptiles and amphibians native to Wisconsin. That'll be at the bottom of the hour. Right now, we're going to take a look at the news and then we'll be back with Dr. Chun. I'm Larry Mueller. taking a look at your pet's health on the show today. Larry Mueller here with Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, veterinary oncologist, clinical professor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She also served as the teaching hospital director at the vet school for a long time as well. It's great to have her with us today. And if you have questions, I hope you'll join in. The number 800-642-1234. You could email to talk@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Kathy in Green Bay will give you a chance to join in. What's on your mind?
Hi, yes. I just have a question. We're avid cat owners and have lost several cats in the past to different types of cancer. And I was wondering, what more can we do as far as a better diet, or is it environmental, or really what can we do to ensure they have a healthy lifespan?
That's so hard when you had multiple animals like that.
Yeah.
And thanks for calling and being a wonderful pet parent and trying to figure out what else you can do. Now there's so many different diets that are on the market, and we're talking a little bit about supplements as well. And one of the things that I would look for when I'm feeding my pet or using any kind of a supplement is it developed with in collaboration with a veterinary nutritionist or a veterinary pharmacologist, so that for supplements, so that there's science behind what's going into it, that it's a balanced, rational diet, and that there's evidence that whatever, you know, the supplement might be actually will make a difference. So looking on the label for, you know, develops in collaboration with a veterinary nutritionist or a veterinary specialist on any of those things. And then, you know, environment, animals are so close to the environment. They walk around, and then, of course, they groom themselves, and that's how they clean. So I do, look for cleaning agents that are approved and safe, non-toxic types of cleaning agents. As I mentioned earlier, we don't really know exactly what causes cancer in dogs or cats beyond a genetic component. But because they are so much closer to their environment and they, you know, lick things off of themselves to clean themselves, I would think about what cleaning products I'm using and make sure that they're non-toxic.
Oh, so the cleaning products you use for the house.
For the house,
yeah,
sure.
I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm. Does the, for cleaning products or for supplements, is the Veterinary Association, are there recommendations within that you could go online and find information like that?
So there is an American College of Veterinary Nutrition that has a lot of fantastic information about diets and what to watch for, not so much on the veterinary supplement side. And we mentioned the American Veterinary Medical Association as a site for information about insurance. To my knowledge, there's not an overarching website or information database about supplements. But looking
at least
for,
from the veterinary.
From the veterinary, yes. Yes, on the human side.
Yeah. Kathy, there you go. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Perry in Ocado, your turn. Hi, Perry.
Yes. Hi, doctor. I was wondering, it's really prevalent that people are very cautious about what's called mean seeds. They're grass awns that can travel. They somehow puncture the dog's skin or get in the nostrils, and they can go all the way to the internal organs. Mm-hmm. And I know the field trial people are really concerned about it. Can you tell us, do you see that much of it? Of course, it's a specific type of dog that would probably run into them, like Canada Rye and Foxtail.
Yep, that's exactly. In my role as an oncologist, I don't see much. I know, though, that certainly our emergency folks and our surgeons do see pets that have or working dogs that have developed these foreign bodies. And you're exactly right. Some of these foxtail-type seeds are sharp, and they will penetrate through fur. They can penetrate through skin, and they can travel in the body, and they can cause a lot of damage. So yes, they are a problem. It's a real issue.
Yeah, something difficult to treat, I imagine, too. Once they
trying to prevent. Yeah. So if you have a field dog, make sure that you check them out before and after their trials and before they're out in the field.
Yeah. Well, it reminds me of sneezing, which Don had emailed about, which is a cat that will occasionally sneeze, maybe a couple, three times.
Yep. And sneezing, just like in people, is a normal thing. And sometimes there might be an irritant in the air if you've just cleaned or dusted, and maybe that's what's making the cat sneeze. Things to watch for that would make me worried and maybe have check out with a veterinarian would be if it's really frequent, if it's almost like paroxysmal, they can't stop sneezing. Certainly if they are bleeding or there's a lot of discharge coming from their nostril, that would be a sign to be worried about. If they're pawing at their face. So an occasional sneeze or two is not something I'd typically be very worried about.
Claudine emailed to say several years ago she enrolled her Cocker Spaniel, I'm sure is just a spelling thing here, Cocker Spaniel, in a vaccine for canine cancer study undertaken by UW and collaborators. Mm-hmm. Sadly, the dog developed inoperable cancer while in the study. While his illness progressed, both Claudine and the dog received excellent supportive care from the veterinary oncology staff. Their compassion and empathy at our final clinic visit still brings tears.
Oh, Claudine, it's a lot to go through with your dog. And thank you for participating in one of the trials that we offer at the vet school. Certainly doing clinical trials to try and identify new ways to either prevent or treat or diagnose diseases in dogs and cats is something that we do as part of a veterinary comprehensive cancer center. And that vaccine against canine cancer trial was a huge project that I want to call out the other collaborators besides UW-Madison, which was University of Arizona and Colorado State University. And in that trial, which my dog also participated in, some of the dogs were vaccinated with this purported vaccine against canine cancer, and some were vaccinated with a placebo. We now that study is done, my dog also sadly developed cancer. And so I think they're in the process of looking at all of that data and trying to determine, gosh, did this vaccine do? Because, boy, that would be a game changer if there was really a way to prevent cancer through a vaccination.
Yeah. And I assume it was a double blind.
Yeah. Yep.
So the vets didn't know.
They didn't know. And, yeah, certainly the owners didn't know which one it was. We hoped, yeah. But it's, you know, part of what we do as well in training students and training other specialists, you know, in oncology or radiation oncology, surgical oncology, any of the specialties, is we want to help people and their animals. And so I'm glad that we were able to support you through that tough time.
Well, we've got spring here, and what would you like to remind pet owners to be wary of at this time of the year?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. Some holidays coming up where we need to be careful about toxic plants. Lilies, of course, are very, very toxic to dogs and cats. And if you have those in the household, want to be real careful about not letting your companion nibble on anything. And so watching for toxic plants. And with spring coming, gosh, it's Wisconsin, and it's not feeling like spring so much, but we know it's coming. Watching for toxins outside as the summer comes up, blue-green algae blooms in the ponds. There have been recently some things, some news about wandering in the dog parks if they're safe to be in. Knowing that we didn't identify any specific toxins, but watching for your animals, especially if you're out in a dog park. What if they've picked up something that's causing a foreign body in their stomach, where maybe they're vomiting, they're not eating normally, things to check out just with an increased awareness of having your dog outside, having them maybe be exposed to things that, you don't always see them eating, and keeping an eye if they're not acting normally to, get them checked out.
Yeah. I was thinking about other plants. I know common plants that are unsafe. I know tulips, which is another
correct.
One this time of the
year. Yep. You know. Tulips, daffodils as well are toxic plants to, dogs and cats. Dumb cane, which is a pretty common house plant that a lot of people have, can yeah. be toxic to plants or to, pets as well.
English ivy, I think, is
mm-hmm.
one.
Mm-hmm.
And even azaleas.
I think you're right. Azaleas are toxic to, pets as well. Is this...
Do we have any pet-safe alternatives?
Well, spider plants, African violets, those are safe alternatives. I think Norwegian pines are safe alternatives. There's actually cat grass, which is, I think, oat grass, that is a plant that you can actually get for your pet to, nibble on if they really like chewing greens.
And orchids, I think, are...
Orchids are safe, correct. And then earlier somebody asked us about cabbage. So if you want to feed your animal leafy greens, some leafy greens is okay. No onions. No onions.
No onions.
Yep. No grapes.
So what happened? I mean, what if you realize your dog, your cat has nibbled away on the tulips or some other toxic plant?
Yeah.
What's the... I'm assuming there's some signs that the animals...
So vomiting would probably be one of the things, or just lethargy where they're kind of lying around, they're not acting themselves. The sooner you recognize that they've eaten something that, might be poisonous to them, the better, so that you can get them in, ideally get them to have the veterinarian get them to vomit. Sometimes they will administer an activated charcoal, just like a human might take if they've ingested something that's poisonous to them. So there's quite a range of the sooner you can catch it, the better.
What are another email? What are some of the advancements of treatment for cancer in dogs and cats that you've seen over the years?
Yeah, I one of the things that's exciting. Although I'm not a radiation oncologist, is being able to become more and more accurate and precise in treating animals with radiation therapy. And back in the day when I was a trainee and a younger clinician, our ability to really conform the radiation therapy beam specifically to the tumor was just not as good. And actually working with colleagues in the medical physics team here on campus, we've been part of a way to develop and make much more conformal, accurate therapy so that we decrease side effects to normal tissue. So I think that's an exciting treatment that I'm really happy to see happening. Other things that are absolutely developing more and more are ways to help stimulate the immune system to fight cancer. We actually have a trial now that is the SOC trial that's looking to seek out canine hemangiosarcoma and find a way to help ideally have the body, have the immune system of the body stimulated to recognize the cancer cells more effectively and be able to use not only medications to fight the cancer cell, but get the body itself and the immune cells to fight the cancer within it. So lots of new ways to stimulate the immune system and identify better treatment options.
And that's working, or that's being utilized or at least experimented on for humans as well.
Yes. That's a very active field in both human and veterinary medicine. And one of the things that makes it gratifying to be a veterinary oncologist is that genetically, cancer in dogs is the same as cancer in people. And we can see the same genetic mutations. We see the same type of biologic behaviors. And yet in our companions, the cancer progresses faster than it might in people. So we can gather information about how does this treatment impact dog cancer more quickly than we could in a human population with that type of disease. And so we can inform not only how do we help dogs or cats more, but also how can this treatment then maybe go on and be used in people?
If I'm thinking back to probably 30 years ago when we had a cat that underwent radiation therapy, mm-hmm. and then had to spend time in a kind of a lead box.
Okay. Yep. Was it?
I'm wondering how, if that's that sort of thing has changed.
That's changed quite a lot. So I think the only time we would have a cat isolated after a treatment is when we're treating them now with radioiodine, just like we do with people that are hyperthyroid. We can treat hyperthyroid cats with a small dose of radioactive iodine, and then they have to wait until that iodine's eliminated from their body, usually 2 or 3 days, and then go home. For most hyperthyroid cats, that's a cure. Not for every hyperthyroid cat. So that has come a long way.
And mm-hmm. does the cat still have to sit in a...
Not in a lead box. No, lead we have box? Actually a nice room with windows where they can see outside, and they have a TV screen that they get to watch and see, you know, Animal Planet playing. So they've got something to keep an eye on while they're waiting for that substance to clear from their body.
I guess I'm kind of happy to hear that because I couldn't imagine how Frosty, not well Frosty did in a box.
You know, we love our animals so much. They're so much a part of our family, and we want the best for them. It's hard to think about them going through difficult treatments like that, yeah.
Are there other experimental things that you're doing at the vet school relating to disease, cancer, and so forth?
For cancers, we have a number of different types of treatment trials using different types of immune therapies to see if we can, again, get the body to recognize cancer cells and attack it on its own. We are also one of our oncologists, Dr. Pan, has developed with colleagues at the medical school a test to try and screen dogs' blood for cancer. And it's still in the relatively early phases, but she's very excited about getting more data, looking at a larger population of animals so we can figure out, is there a way that we can actually just do a blood test that can then help identify early on, before an animal is sick from its cancer, what might be happening.
And if you catch it early?
So early detection in animals, just like in people, is key to better long-term control. So that's like when we have a dog with a hemangiosarcoma in its spleen and we don't identify it until it's ruptured, the dog has bled, has become weak, and now the tumor is spread, our treatment options are not as effective as if we caught it before it even caused any problems for the dog, recognize that there's something there, and then removed it. So that early detection and treatment.
So a common question we get is, my dog or my cat has this disease and it's getting into its end of life stages, but I can't tell. I'm wondering, when is the time to call it a day, to speak?
Boy. Larry, that's a tough question to answer. Having had my own animals where they were sick with cancer or other diseases, I had a dog with dementia, and you want to give them every good day possible, and you want to be with them, and making that decision to say goodbye and end their life is a tough one. And I think back to other colleagues and words of wisdom where it's better to make that decision a day too early than a day too late. And it's better to plan ahead and have it be in a controlled setting where you and the animal are in a place that you want to be, where you're comfortable, as opposed to, gosh, it's 2 o'clock in the morning, my animal is just crying out in pain, or it's having a seizure, and now I have to drive to the emergency clinic and have it done somewhere I don't know the people. I'm stressed. It's a tough situation.
On another note, Karen emailed us to say the UW Vet School is wonderful. They treated Karen's horse for navicular disease. The horse lived another 3 years thanks to their treatment and care.
That's so fantastic to hear. And when I was the hospital director for a few years, I worked very closely with the large animal hospital team, and I couldn't be more proud of them and the job they do. They have a solid team of medical doctors and surgical surgeons. We have farriers, so not people that know how to shoe and trim a horse's foot, and they work with our doctors to address very specific problems like navicular disease that can be such a crippling issue in horses. We have just such a wide range of diagnostic tools. For those of you that had called and asked over many times, when is the nuclear medicine, the nuclear imaging program coming back? It's coming back this spring. It's finally back online. So that's very, very exciting to be able to offer again. And that, between that and our standing CT scanner, our ability to do MRIs, we have a big, beautiful indoor arena, indoor in Wisconsin, where we can do very good lameness examinations and assessments. So we are really excited about the opportunities for our large animal clients.
You know, you spent more than a decade in the position of teaching hospital director at UW. What do you see as your legacy there?
I guess my legacy, I hope, is for the folks that work there knowing that change is constant, and there's always something to be working on and getting better at. And we're not striving for perfection; we're striving to always do better and help people in new ways. And for the pet owner, I'm so proud of WhisCares. I'm so proud of the fact that we've expanded. We can offer the most incredible, over-the-top, new treatment options, and we can meet people where they are and say, veterinary medicine is expensive, and here are some other options that we can try and see what works for you and your animal.
And on that note, Dr. Chun, thank you so much for being with us today and for the work you've done.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
It's been wonderful. Dr. Ruth Ann Chun, our guest, veterinary oncologist, clinical professor at the UW School of Veterinary Medicine, and great to have her with us. Maybe we'll get her back and do it again. Thank you again, Ruth Ann.
Thank you so much.
Coming up, we are going to take a look at some of the wild reptiles and amphibians native to Wisconsin and a new law that's you need to know about, for sure, when it comes to reptiles and amphibians in our state. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. The Wisconsin DNR has adopted a new rule relating to collecting and keeping as pets wild reptiles and amphibians native to Wisconsin. Could have an impact on you, and certainly will have an impact on others here in the state. We're going to talk about it today with reptile educator Bill Stewart. Bill is owner of WPS Reptiles, LLC. It's a Kenosha-based reptile education business. Bill's also a board member for Badgerland Reptile Rescue. That's an organization that finds homes for surrendered reptiles and amphibians. And as we talk with him, I hope you'll join in. Do your children like to catch frogs or maybe turtles or snakes from a nearby pond or field? Did you know that there are some new regulations relating to that? Give us a call. The number, 800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. Or send us an email to talk@WPR.org. That's talk@WPR.org. Bill Stewart, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us once again. Appreciate it very much.
You bet. I'm glad to be back. Thank you for having me back, Larry.
So what's the new policy here, the new law?
So right now, as it stands in the state of Wisconsin, you are allowed to possess a certain number of each kind of species. So you can have up to 5 bull snakes. You can have up to 5 fox snakes. You can have only 3 snapping turtles. I think sometimes it's 10. It is written a little vaguely, but you are allowed to have these species. If they are albinos or they're different colors or patterns, they don't count in that bag limit. Then there's not a tremendous amount of people that are going out in the wild and capturing these to keep as pets. Another topic is that, you know, going out in the wild and capturing an animal and keeping it as a pet, they usually don't thrive that well in captivity. It's always best to leave them in the wild when you see them. But the policy changes that the DNR is proposing is that you're only allowed to keep a native species for 24 hours. And what they're intending to do is encourage families to, if they find a turtle or they find a frog, that you can keep it, you could show your kids, and then you're re-releasing it back into the wild in enough time frame where it's not going to be hindered by being in captivity or being kept as a pet for too long. And I think that's kind of the principle of which they're operating. So any native species that you have, bull snakes, fox snakes, garter snakes, snapping turtles, you can have them for 24 hours, and then the idea is that you're going to be re-releasing them in the wild within enough time frame where they can adapt back into the wild without any, you know, major issues. But it is, there's a nuance to this rule that is going to maybe adversely affect some people in the state.
Yeah. Well, you've spent years giving presentations about reptile keeping.
I do.
So what do you tell people about this rule, or what will you?
I haven't had too much of an opportunity to speak about it. And I think part of the reason is that there seems to be kind of a divide between the reptile hobbyists and breeders and these proposals within the DNR. But as an educator, I kind of try to stay neutral and in the middle. While I understand the challenges that are going to be faced with reptile breeders and keepers, I understand the intentions of the DNR, and I'm hoping to maybe find some middle ground where the DNR and the reptile hobbyists can work together. But I'm definitely trying to maintain an objective approach to this, but it will, you know, affect the future keeping of these animals. And I think it's a really nuanced topic, Larry, and I'm kind of hearing both sides of the argument and trying to navigate my way through this. I think the only concern that I have, and I think this is not just unique to Wisconsin, but just unique to wherever reptiles are, we have over 20 species of snake in Wisconsin. We have plenty of species of turtle and frog. And while we want to preserve the native reptiles so our children and their children can enjoy them, human population growth and development, you know, industrial growth, taking lands and fields where these animals live and building, you know, subdivisions and housing developments, we're reducing the natural habitat that these animals can live in. And it's hard to conserve a species of animal without also protecting their environment. And so I think that's something that needs to be attended to. I'm not saying the DNR is ignoring that, but when we talk about conserving and protecting species, we can't ignore the environmental strain, you know, and the environmental tie-in that these animals have. I feel like I went a little off tangent there.
No, go ahead.
I think the challenges of coming in as if you go look at a wild snake, and I think bull snakes are a beautiful native species. They can get really large. They can get 6-7 feet. They're a gorgeous animal, and they are protected in the state of Wisconsin. But the people that are keeping and breeding them are keeping different color variations. They're keeping albinos. They're keeping ones that have white patches on them. They're called white-sided. And I think the challenge is coming in where a lot of the genetic colorations that we have as captive pets that we're breeding look very different than the wild animals. But I think it could be really hard to tell to the common eye. And I think that's where the DNR is coming in to try to regulate some of the breeding of these animals in captivity, because it's really hard to tell the difference between one that's wild and one that maybe is captive bred with a different color or pattern.
Bill Stewart, our guest of WPS Reptiles in Kenosha, it's great to have him with us today. Questions, give a call at 800-642-1234. Email to talk at WPR.org. Bill in Hayward called but couldn't stay with us. He's concerned that rural townships grade their sandy roads during turtle hatching season in the spring. Bill says a lot of newborn turtles, he feels, die as a result. Is the DNR aware of this, and can townships be told to stop?
That is an awesome question, and I appreciate his concern for the native species. That's really remarkable. Bill, you said his name was Bill in Hayward?
Yeah.
Bill in Hayward would need to reach out to his local DNR officers, because the DNR does consider that. And I don't know if they're doing anything specifically in Hayward right now, but I have seen efforts. There are streets in Madison, Wisconsin that have salamander crossing signs, and they're regulating and watching the migration patterns of salamanders in the spring, because it will affect the native population. So if the DNR are unaware of this road, they should be made aware of this road so they can come in and try to do some type of interventions to help these animals kind of survive that early migration.
What?
That was a really cool question.
Yeah. Let's talk about the collection of wild reptiles and amphibians. So there are there actually companies or that do this?
To my knowledge, there are not anybody to any big degree that are out wild collecting native species. And running a reptile rescue, we don't get native species surrendered. We rarely do. So I'm not in possession of too many native species right now. I don't think there's a huge problem with people going out and collecting native species. I know from a reptile hobbyist and breeder perspective, it's very frowned upon. There are, again, it's a nuanced topic. It's not all bad or all good.
Yeah, yeah.
But we really try to, like, deter people from going out and keeping a snake as a pet. They usually don't transition to captivity really well. They usually don't thrive as well in captivity. And, you know, going to a pet expo or going to a pet shop and buying a reptile pet from there is a way better option, because they're captive bred. They don't have any, exposure to parasites or bacterias. Or pathogens that a wild animal would. It's a way better option to just go buy a pet from a pet shop, or even better, from a local breeder. There are ways to get your reptile pet rather than collecting them. But I, in my knowledge and experience, haven't seen the wild collecting of reptiles in Wisconsin to be any sort of an issue.
So this new rule, this 24-hour rule, shouldn't have an impact, or it doesn't have an effect on the buying and selling of wild Wisconsin reptiles.
It will. It will. Because if someone is selling or buying Wisconsin native reptiles, the implication would be that it's been in your possession for longer than 24 hours. I think it's going to be a hard thing for them to enforce. And I think there, it's going to lead to some, challenging issues for the DNR moving forward. And I'm not a representative of the DNR, so I'm only speaking from my perspective. But I'm curious how they're going to enforce knowing that someone's only had it for 24 hours, knowing when they collected a snake. But if someone wants to keep and breed a native species, most of the time they're purchasing them from out of state. So anyone in Wisconsin who's breeding native bull snakes are buying these bull snakes that are hatched in captivity from other states where you're allowed to breed them and you're allowed to keep them as pets. No one is really going out in the wild capturing bull snakes and breeding them in captivity. So it's not a problem per se that requires enforcement.
All right, that makes sense. And Bill, I should have asked you right off the top, even though you've been on the show in the past, but explain, you own WPS Reptiles. Tell us about your business there, your organization.
I formally legitimized the business in 2021, where I travel and I do reptile education. And I do have exotic animals. So the reptiles that I bring, lizards, snakes, tortoises, they're not Wisconsin native species. They're not found in the state. They're usually exotic. And my whole purpose is just to educate and teach people about these animals. There still are a tremendous amount of, misunderstandings about the animals and their behaviors. There still is a lot of myths that circulate reptiles. And some are harmless, like snakes are slimy, where they're not necessarily slimy. And some are harmful, where, people are worried that snakes are actively trying to chase and kill them. Snakes don't want to hurt people. They just see us as threats. And so reptile education is so important because we need to help people recognize and understand that you might be afraid of these animals, you might not like these animals, but they have a very important role in their ecosystems, and it's crucial that they are a part of these ecosystems. And, you know, a dead snake can't support its ecosystem and habitat the way a live snake can.
So
that's my biggest thing. But we're teaching people about their biologies and about their diets, and ideally, in certain situations, helping people overcome that fear too. And through experience and safe education and safe interactions, people can ideally begin to overcome that fear of snakes or any reptile.
Don in Madison, I believe, has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Don.
Yeah, good morning. I'm wondering if there's a grandfather clause to the DNR regulation about only holding a reptile for 24 hours. And the reason I bring that up is we have a turtle, a pet turtle, which was bought legally in another state 36 years ago. And if we had to release it, it will absolutely not survive.
No, it won't.
No, it won't.
what species of turtle is it, Don? Do you know?
Box.
It's a box turtle?
It's a dry land turtle.
A box turtle.
So, yes, there is going to be grandfathering. So anyone who currently owns any native species will have to register those native species with the DNR by 2027, I believe. And the DNR is not going to come and confiscate any animals. They're not going to take your animals away. As long as you're registering them by 2027, you'll be able to keep them. It's going to inhibit the ability for people to breed them and have babies because they will fall outside of you. Now you have more snakes that you've obtained from when you registered, but they're not going to come in and take animals away. There is a little bit of carefulness, Don, with that topic, because in the state of Wisconsin, ornate box turtles are native and highly protected. Even if they came from out of state, ornate box turtles are protected. Eastern box turtles are fine to own as pets. And so, no, you should be okay. You should be grandfathered in with your box turtle.
Yeah, I would think if you had one for 36 years, even if it was an ornate, they're not going to tell you to release that.
No, it would not. No. Unfortunately, under some really, really certain circumstances, the DNR might confiscate the turtle if it's an ornate box turtle, and then they're placed in a nature program. I'm assuming it's an eastern box turtle because ornate box turtles are not.
Yeah.
You're not going to go buy an ornate box turtle from a pet shop. So it's either a three-toed or it's an eastern box turtle, which is fine to keep. They're not native species, and you'll be fine with your box turtle.
Don, there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Bill Stewart, our guest today, owner of WPS Reptiles of Kenosha. It's great to have him with us, and you can join in, 800-642-1234. I'm Larry Mueller for WPR News. Great to have you along today as we talk about the DNR's new rule that's proposed for prohibiting the collection and keeping as pets wild reptiles and amphibians native to Wisconsin for no more than 24 hours with our guest Bill Stewart of WPS Reptiles Kenosha. Josh in Whitewater has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Josh.
Hey, Larry. First, I just wanted to thank Bill for the education work he does. I think that's fantastic to educate about amphibians and reptiles. My expertise is in amphibians and reptiles. I've been on Larry's show in the past, and I just wanted to mention, I think it's incorrect that you can collect five wild bull snakes specifically because they're a protected species. And so I just want to make sure that it's clear that you can't collect wild bull snakes in the state and keep those as pets.
All right.
You're saying you can or you cannot?
Cannot.
You cannot.
I think you're right, and I appreciate the correction. I know there's bag limits on certain species, and I thought bull snakes were part of that. You're allowed to possess at least five of the bull snakes, but I'll have to go back and double check. I think you might be right, and I appreciate the correction.
Yes.
I was under the assumption that the bull snakes were part of that five species You can have five bull snakes, five fox snakes.
But
so I will. Yeah. Thank you for that. Thank you for that call. I'll go back and check my notes when this is done.
Josh, thank you for calling. Appreciate it. Mark in Scandinavia, your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi. I wondered if the DNR is emphasizing that they should re-release the animals that they keep for 24 hours in the same spot, because some animals know their territory very well. They know where their hibernacula are, and they probably wouldn't survive if you just take something from one area and just dump them in another area.
Yeah.
Yeah, the DNR would have to answer that a little bit more detailed, but they are very aware of that. There are... So the ordinances and the proposals that they're working on, is part of it is reducing the bag limit, reducing the amount of species you can keep to only have them for 24 hours. But they are doing some other changes that are going to be very positive. And one is that you are not allowed to mess with a reptile's hibernaculum without prior DNR approval. So if you have a hibernaculum in your backyard, and just for your listeners too, a lot of reptiles will hibernate during the winter. And it's not hibernate like bears. Like, they're still awake. They just slow their metabolisms down. So in the reptile world, we call it brumating, where they're still sort of conscious. They slow their metabolisms down, but they're not asleep like a bear would hibernate. And like garter snakes, for example, will find these underground dens, and there's hundreds of them at the same time. And while it's very fascinating to observe, if you're in your backyard and you have a hibernaculum where you have 150 garter snakes in your backyard, it could be a nuisance. You're not allowed to interfere or mess with or destroy that hibernaculum in any way unless you have permission from the DNR. But with permission from the DNR, you can kind of relocate it. But they are imposing rules where if you are moving a nuisance animal, you have to move them within 1 mile of where you found them. So if you have a nuisance animal in your garage or in your backyard, with permission from the DNR, you can relocate them, but it has to be within a mile. So I would assume, given that language, that keeping an animal for 24 hours and re-releasing, the expectation would be you're releasing it where you found it or within a mile from where you found it. Because reptiles are very tied to their ecosystems, and they could have a hard time finding their way if they're released too far away from where they were found.
Mark, thank you very much for calling. Jim wonders, what are the, you talked about their role in the ecosystem of snakes, for example. What is their role in the ecosystem?
So the simplest answer to that is that snakes are going to eat all of the things that we don't like in our gardens, all the things we don't want in our homes. Rat snakes, bull snakes, fox snakes, they're eating mice and they're eating rats. Snakes don't carry diseases themselves that are going to transfer to humans, but mice and rats do. You know, anyone that has mice or rats in their houses know that they're a nuisance to some degree. And so snakes are going to eat that. Garter snakes in your garden are eating, you know, any bugs, even frogs and toads, they're eating the nuisance animals. And it's just the circle of life. It's just that they're an integral part of that food chain and that web of life where they're, you know, they are food for, you know, higher level animals, higher order animals. They're eating lower order animals, and it's, you know, disrupting that in any way can disrupt the balance of the ecosystem.
There, you
it's
know,
way more than that, but that's my short radio answer.
Well, the I know I've at least I'm been aware of at least a couple of places that actually have events like. It might be turtle racing, or it might be frog jumping here in Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken. Are these events, are the rules relating to these events?
Yeah, the DNR is going to, you're not going to have frog jumping contests and turtle races anymore. And the problem with those is that there are a myriad of pathogens that frogs and turtles have. The biggest one, you know, that you could look up right now is the chytrid fungus with frogs. And the chytrid fungus in other areas of the world have, like, decimated frog populations pretty bad. And it spreads very quickly. And I believe there are some documented... My buddy Josh, who just called here, could answer this question, too. There are documented cases of chytrid fungus, I believe, in Wisconsin, if I'm not mistaken. And so the idea of outlawing turtle races and frog jumping contests... is those animals are collected from the wild, they're all kept together for a short period of time, and then they're all released in the wild. And what a very rapid way to spread pathogens and spread, you know, funguses. And so outlawing that practice is going to inhibit those pathogens from spreading crazy like they would in those kind of situations.
Yeah. The United States Association of Reptile Keepers has opposed the rule change. They argue, I guess, that it would do more harm than good by incentivizing poaching and illegal activities.
That's a really nuanced conversation. So I am a volunteer with the United States Association of Reptile Keepers also, and they are specifically opposing the five species bag limit for the 24-hour possession. And just generally speaking, how do I summarize this for the audience? People want reptiles as pets. They're becoming very popular pets right now. And if you're looking at collecting a snake from the wild versus buying one having one as a pet versus buying one that's captive bred, it's always better to buy the healthy captive bred option. And so people aren't wild collecting these animals because they can buy these captive bred options. If we restrict the ability to captive breed these snakes and people want these snakes, it could, you know, indirectly be encouraging them to go wild collect a snake. So let's use the bull snake, for example. And I'm definitely summarizing this. This is such a more nuanced topic, but I want a bull snake. I think they're pretty. I think they're wonderful. I can go to a pet shop, I can go to a reptile expo, and I can buy a very healthy, captive-bred, disease-free snake, and I can keep it as a pet. But now I can't because they're not allowed to be bred, but I want my bull snake, so now I'm going to go capture one because I still want my snake and I can't go buy it. That's one of the arguments. You know, in captivity, we're also breeding different color patterns and morphs, and these are animals that really won't survive in the wild because they don't blend in quite to the degree that a wild type snake can. So a bull snake that's missing its patterns or that's white with red eyes like an albino is not going to survive in the wild. The DNR is allowing those animals to still be bred. There's just some nuance to some of these different color patterns that resemble the normal bull snake to where it's hard to tell the difference. And that's kind of where the challenge is coming from. But it's, you know, I mean, anytime you restrict an animal from being captive bred, then, you know, the availability of that animal as a pet goes down, then prices can go up. And then if a bull snake that costs $100 now costs $500 or $600, you might incentivize someone to go out in the wild and capture bull snakes because now I can sell them in the black market for $600. So there's a lot of nuance to this conversation, and it's not so cut and dry.
Boy, oh boy, oh boy. You're involved in Badgerland Reptile Rescue. In our last 45 seconds, people want to surrender a native amphibian or reptile. You help.
So we do work very closely with the DNR, and we have a very excellent relationship with the DNR. And so if anyone has a native species and they're concerned, or they are looking to surrender it, they can email us at info@badgerlandrescue.com, info@badgerlandrescue.com, and they can speak to my wife, Sarah, and I about the nuances of what's going on. And we could either take the snake or we can direct them to local resources in their area and support them.
Bill, always a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking time to be with us today. It flew by, and I really appreciate it. We'll look forward to another visit.
Yeah, thank you so much, Larry. Thank you guys for listening.
Bill Stewart, owner of WPS Reptiles, LLC. It's a Kenosha-based reptile education business, and a board member he is for the Badgerland Reptile Rescue that finds homes for surrendered reptiles and amphibians. Great to have him with us. An interesting 2 hours today, and I want to thank you for listening in. Appreciate that as well. And a big thanks to our team, Clara Neipert, Joel Patnod, Lee Rayburn, and Jeff Robbins, all part of the staff. Our executive producer is Jill Nadol. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots more in store here on WPR News.